Wonderful. Thank you, Dave and band there. I'm very excited about this morning, a very special morning. We're calling Dear Nexus, and I'm not quite sure our presenters are ahead by a century, but they are ahead of most of us by a few years. And so this morning we have seven presenters from the, how shall I call it, the second half of life, who are going to be sharing with us their wisdom, their reflections on life. Well, as the song mentions, we have no dress rehearsal. So I think there's value in time sitting back and reflecting and hearing from those who are more seasoned than us about what constitutes a good life. 5 years ago, I read Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upward. And it was an incredibly liberating book for me because in it, he talks about spending the first half of life building a container. And that was really liberating for me because it allowed me to think in different ways. And then he talks, of course, about how we spend the second half of life. And this morning, what I have simply done is I approached a number of people from Nexus who are in the second half of life, who have been with us here at Nexus for a number of years, and simply asked them, if you had 5 minutes to share anything with Nexus about life, what would it be? 5 minutes, anything you want to say, what would you say to us? And so, we have our seven presenters over here ready to do exactly that. Of course, being in the second half of life doesn't mean you're necessarily wise, but there is a certain wisdom that comes with simply having more life experience. Perhaps a simplicity on the other side of complexity. And so what they have to offer this morning, I've read through them all, it is wonderful stuff. A lot of it sometimes might perhaps contradict each other, but there are some certain things here that I think are beautiful for us to hear. And so I hope you'll just sit back and enjoy the wisdom of our elders, shall we call it. Anyway, I'm gonna start by asking Judy to come forward. She's gonna lead us off and then we'll go with the flow.
Dear Nexus, it seems as though there are two quite separate parts of my adult life. In the first part, I was a stay-at-home mom with 5 kids. And once my children had moved into teen and adult years, in my second half, I went back to school and became a psychotherapist. We all know nothing is quite so consistent as change in life, and yet, we can also resist change. How many of us have admitted, I don't like change or I don't do well with change? Virginia Satir, a family systems psychologist, said people find themselves in places that are uncomfortable and tend to stay there rather than face the unknown and move forward. She also noted, however, when our emotional pain becomes too great, we're then forced to consider change. How do you know when it's time to make a change? When is it the right time? How do you even recognize your discomfort? When I was a stay-at-home mom, I often had the feeling the world was passing me by. I remember standing in line at a grocery store and watching the cashier use a new computerized cash register, thinking, I am so out of the mainstream of life. I'm not even capable of learning how to use an automated cash register. In my day-to-day life, I also noticed there were times when I felt a deep sense of restlessness. What was beyond the realm of motherhood? I didn't always understand my restlessness. In some strange way, I kept trying to push it away. I would respond by telling myself, I should be content with what I had and be grateful for what was my life. While my visceral instinctive feeling was telling me to consider a change, some of my old beliefs held me captive. The common fear of failure, and again, that internal belief that I should be content with what I have. Over the years since that time, I've learned that this visceral experience in my body, or another way of putting it, my gut instinct or intuition, provides me with really good information. Change removes our safety nets, our known way of life. What we know and what we understand shifts to the unknown, and uncertainties can feel overwhelming to us. Richard Rohr, a Franciscan Catholic priest, has a beautiful way of encouraging change. Rohr describes this as liminal change and says, "This is where we are betwixt and between the familiar and the completely unknown. There alone, our old world is left behind, and while we are not yet sure of the new existence, that's a good space where genuine newness can begin. Get there often and stay as long as you can by whatever means possible. This is a sacred space where the old world is able to fall apart and a bigger world is revealed." And for me, the process of leaving my old world behind was making the decision to go back to school. You might think that would be a relatively straightforward decision, but people in my world really pushed back on that. Friends would ask me, "Why do you want to do this?" Friends would ask me, "Why would I want to do this?" Not in a curious way, but in a very judgmental way. And someone else asked me, "Why do you want to listen to all that crap?" Another person said, "Therapy isn't really effective. Only giving one's life to the Lord is where true change begins." And then there was the uncertainty of investing in education and unsure of what the outcome would be. So, in answer to my three earlier questions, how do you know when it's time to make a change? When is it the right time? How do we recognize the call to change? I want you to know that your body might be telling you a different message than your thinking process. Pay attention to that gut instinct. And when you begin to respond to your inner process, do so with curiosity and compassion. Ask yourself, "What's going on for me?" We often pay more attention to our thoughts than messages our bodies are giving us. Knowing when the time is right, it's always a process, and learn to be at peace with that. Change is incremental and should be done from a strength-based perspective, not chaos. Trust that you'll know the right time. For me, leaving my old world behind, which I quite literally did, has been life-changing for me in every way. Going back to school introduced me to new ways of thinking, new perspectives, new people who thought differently than me, and as well, I experienced a significant spiritual shift. It's been an incredibly rich experience.
So, for those of you at 180 degrees to the screen, it's a corn stalk that says corn maze for old people. So I'll start off with trying to find the humor in every stage of life. Those shots they take at old people actually are pretty funny. So, using the term elder is terrifying for me. It suggests that all my long years of experience have led to wisdom. And since I live with myself, I feel justified in asking you only to refer to me as old. So I come here knowing that simple age is not enough. Every piece of advice I give is, in a sense, a damning statement, because even knowing the truth is no guarantee I'm going to do it. And that is what leads me to share some of the following. Dear Nexus, my top 16 list for life, kind of, in no particular order. 1, stop pretending. Instantly admit when you don't know. Faking is fatal. Admission of ignorance leads to a chance to really learn and will give you a glimpse of humility. It also can be very embarrassing, and that's probably why people hesitate to admit ignorance. Two, respond to the admission of ignorance with grace. If you have something of value to pass on, do it with humility. There was a time when you didn't know either. Three, God is always at work, and he doesn't seem to mind that we don't get it. So often, only in hindsight, am I able to see that God's truth found its way through. And even when it didn't, it seemed to be a shadow of dissatisfaction that hung over a poor choice or decision. Four, the goal is not the thing. The journey is the thing. Any goal you may have achieved is the result of so many things that went before it. No real journey, no real goal. Learn to love the journey. And the journey of faith has been the most interesting because it involves every part of your life. Five, and for those of you at 180 degrees again, this is one of my favorite cartoons. For those of you that can't read it, it's got a chart starting at 1 AD, and it's Christian churches and Christian movements throughout history. And the teacher is saying, so this is where our movement came along and finally got the Bible right. And one of the kids is saying, Jesus is so lucky to have us. So the kingdom of God is just so much broader than our personal or corporate or denominational interpretations of Scripture and our narrow definitions of salvation and faith. Don't spend so much effort trying to narrow it down to a few who got it right. No one got it right, and God still loves us. I have no idea how many will spend eternity with Jesus. I actually hope it's everybody. But it has to be more than those allowed by the many narrow descriptions of salvation and interpretations of Scripture that are used by so many. Jesus is a gatekeeper for eternity, not our narrow definitions. Six, the best description of the gospel or the good news I know comes from Dallas Willard. The good news is we get to join God in what he is doing right here and right now in this world. Seven, the church is flawed, but it's the best we have. Eight, we were made for relationship of all kinds. Sorry, introverts, I'm not letting you off the hook, and I might ask the extroverts to tone it down a bit. Nine, try not to beat up on yourself so much. As I've gotten older, I've discovered that I continue to disappoint myself, not God. One of my favorite authors was an alcoholic until the day he died. I'm not here to promote alcoholism or addiction of any kind, but they are not impediments to the love of God. Yes, we fail. Yes, we are unworthy. Yes, we continually disappoint ourselves. But no, this does not remove us from the love of God or having God use us. We all know the impossible task God would have if he only used perfect people. Not much work getting done, eh? Read the Bible. I love that it never hides the faults of the characters that God is using. God only uses the service of frail and failing people. 10. The life of the Christian is not one of moving through darkness into permanent light. It used to be called when I was young, God has a wonderful plan for your life. The Christian life is more about finding light in the darkness. 11. Struggle is necessary, important, and permanent part of life in this world. God's promise is never to make our lives smooth or problem-free. God's promise to be with us no matter what life does to us in the valley of death. We have the promise of a present God who will help us handle the difficulties of this world in the best way possible for us. And we always have the option to refuse or ignore the help. 12, one of the battles that we continually engage in is the battle between what God offers and what the world offers. This is a battle worth fighting. Do your best to separate the ideologies of this world from the teachings of Jesus, and do your best to see where the world has actually figured out some of Jesus' ways, even if they don't give him credit. 13, I am proud and ashamed of what my generation has done. I have hope that your generation will do better. I do understand the disdain there seems to be around old white guys, but I plead with you to try to see more than our failures. 14, the balanced life has no room for sacrifice. And finally, 15, talk to kids. I know they only give one word answers so often, but you're the adult in the room. Figure it out. Okay, I know I said 16, but I was never good at math. Math is crucial to our lives, but only a few have to, only a select few actually have to understand it, thank goodness.
So this is supposed to be a 5-minute talk on what we've learned and you might benefit from. But before I do that, I'd like to mention some things I wish I hadn't learned. This advice has no benefit whatsoever, and it's simply BS. For example, when I was young, I learned you shouldn't go swimming after lunch. You might get a cramp so bad you'd lose your ability to swim and you'd drown. Is that something that's still taught? No, but that was gospel when I was a kid, honestly. You couldn't swim during the hottest part of the day, right after lunch. It's ridiculous. I could go on and on. There's lots of those. But here's another old adage, which at best is misleading. I still hear my dad saying it. Money doesn't grow on trees, you know. But of course money grows on trees. Income-producing, appreciating assets are, in effect, money trees. And what's fantastic about money trees is you can finance them, and the income they produce pays for the financing. Like, I could speak for an hour on money myths, but I only have 5 minutes, so that's enough of that. There's a whole nother waft of advice that really rubs me the wrong way, and perhaps it's well-intentioned, but it has the effect of keeping people in their place. The advice goes like this: suck it up, buttercup. It's not going to kill you to stick with it, is it? And people have even put a Christian spin on it. Maybe you need to grow where you're planted. Or worse yet, people say things to themselves that only keep them stuck. They say, I'm waiting for God's leading, or I'm waiting for God to open a door for me. This stuff makes me bristle. I really believe God wants us to be captains of our own lives. Psalm 32:9 says, do not be like the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, but must be controlled by bit and bridle. You know, understanding, just designing things yourself, not just by default, with a bridle pulling you whichever way you want to go. As far as I can tell, Jesus didn't say, wait for my leading. He said, seek and ye shall find. He didn't say, just wait and I'll open a door for you. He said, knock and the door shall be opened to you. I guess what I've learned is if I don't like something about my life, I have the God-given right to design it differently. Not by the way I've always done it, not how my parents did it, but by my own design. If we were made in God's image, we might benefit from taking cues from how he created the world. Genesis says, the world was dark and empty and had no form, and God hovered over the waters. I love the word, hovered over the waters. I don't know, just maybe trying to figure out how to make it better, I assume. He soon figured out that he needed to add some light to make it better. And that went on for 6 different phases, so the story goes. So I've learned that if you hover over your life from 10,000 feet, let's say, you can find those dark and empty places and bring light to them. But you need to spend some time on this. If I had to leave you with one piece of advice this morning, it's practical, I'd say get up a little bit earlier in the morning. When I was a kid, I'd get up at 7:30, and the bus came at 8:10. So the only thing I'd had time to prepare for, I just wolfed down some breakfast, combed my hair, I had hair then, and then, you know, we're searching for knowledge at the time, so you read the cornflakes box like 5 times every day. Like, what is that? I could be reading my life goals. And then you have no time. I still remember my mom, you know, we lived on a farm, so we had to go, I'd be running to the bus, and my mom would be running after me with her barn boots on and her apron and her wig on crooked. Jakey, don't forget your lunch! And so get up earlier. It's a great thing. I could go on and on about that, but here's a piece of advice about marriage. for staying married and raising kids. Next year, Judy and I will be 40 years married. So when we were raising five kids at home and I worked long hours, it was easy for Judy and I to feel disconnected and far away from each other. So we began the habit of having coffee. I know I'm lucky, but anyway, coffee together for, that's about 10,000 conversations. Sorry. We also instituted date nights. We go every single week. Even when the kids were young, you get a babysitter. Who cares? They cry. Get over it. They all turned out to be pretty decent. And I think the best thing you can do as a parent is stay happily married. Anyway, sorry about that. One more piece of advice. I like to share a little trick I've used for almost my whole life. I don't know, I was raised in a Christian home, so I learned mommy, daddy, and Jesus pretty much all at the same time. But it helps me keep mentally healthy, and that is that we can control our the focus of our thoughts. Let's face it, no one else is going to do that for you. You can't hire somebody to exercise for you. You can't get anybody to control your thoughts. You have to do that yourself. So here's a little trick that I've learned. If something's bugging me, I write it down and I pray and strategize about it every day. And like I said, I get up early and it's been incremental. So for me, for the last 20 years, it's 4:30 in the morning. Most times it's before that, but anyway, so when worry crops up in the middle of the day, I just change the channel. I say to myself, I'm not dealing with that right now. Instead, I say, you got this. You and God are dealing with it, but just not right now. So in summary, get good advice, but make up your own mind. If you don't like something, change it. Live your life by design, not by default. Get up early and pray. It's good for your mental health.
Christy couldn't be here this morning, so I'm going to read her letter for her. Dear Nexus, being asked for my opinion, wow, I've been a physician for 30 years and have been asked for my opinion regarding medical symptoms and management of problems many times, but this is the first time that I've been asked to impart general pearls of wisdom. I was a bit overwhelmed by the request, bringing to mind the response that Brad should have asked a more adultier adult for advice on how to live life. At first, I just laughed at Brad's request, especially because he was trying so hard not to call us old. But then I put a fair amount of thought into what I would have liked to have heard when I was 25. What might have made the last 30 plus years a bit easier if I'd known it sooner? I teach medical students at McMaster, and as a part of my orientation, I attended a lecture by one of the university's inclusion and diversity officers. They asked us to situate ourselves socially. In doing that exercise, I realized that my strongest identity was that of doctor. So my two bits of wisdom both come from my professional life. One of my goals throughout my career that I don't always achieve, unfortunately, is that of kindness. I watched a friend one day at work in the emergency department dealing with a particularly annoying patient. I mean truly annoying in that fingernail on blackboard way. No matter what the patient said, Beth was calm, non-judgmental, and compassionate. At the same time, she was firm regarding the patient's management and didn't allow the patient anything beyond what she felt was best. It was like a masterclass in dealing with difficult patients. I asked her afterwards how she managed this, and she said that she just tried to be kind. So, in a nerdy medical way, the first thing I did was look up the definition for kind. Kind is defined as benevolent, friendly, generous, and sympathetic. In the past, I've thought of kindness in the same way that I did about niceness. It was an empty compliment, something that was said about someone for whom you couldn't find anything more interesting to comment about. I felt that it was a cliche because most people are kind. However, I've learned over the years that it is not as commonplace as one would think, and yet it is so valuable. I've found that in attempting to be kind, I come across as more compassionate, empathetic, less rushed in my encounters with others, perhaps more mindful. I've noted that when I'm kind, it seems to be infectious. I see others monitoring their speech and behaviors as well. The other characteristic that I've discovered is valuable is that of curiosity, which is defined as a strong desire to learn or know something. I've always been incredibly curious about how things work, and I think that's why I went into medicine, curiosity about the best machine ever built, the human body. But I recently have learned that curiosity can be a real way of overcoming differences. Why someone believes what they believe, what frame of reference they're using, what collection of experiences and events brought them to this particular position or approach to life. The thought is, instead of jumping straight to judgment or attempting to change their mind or formulating the best rebuttal, you simply are curious, and if possible, ask more questions. Do I always do this? Of course not. But when I do, relationships remain intact, and there are relatively fewer hard feelings. I'm sorry that I could not be here to read this myself. I'm off at an art show trying to expand my identity from simply a physician to someone who's a bit more multidimensional. But that's another bit of wisdom for another day. Thanks, Christy.
Don't worry, I'm the last of the old white bald guys coming up here. Those of you who may be more senior and wonder why you didn't get asked, you don't fit the mold. When Brad approached us and asked if we would be willing to share some wisdom, I sort of felt like a series that a former pastor of ours at another church did. It was called Closer to Almost Being There, which I think is a brilliant title for a series. Well, wisdom, not there, but I'm closer to almost being there, and my many years has taught me something about that. Anyway, here we go. It's not about you. Great opening line. It's the first line of the first chapter of a book titled A Purpose-Driven Life. And it's true. It's not about you. That's obvious to everyone, isn't it? It's about me, not you. It's about my happiness, what gives me fulfillment, my purpose, my pleasure, my rights, me, not you. That's what you're here for, so that I can get all of that. That seems to be what motivates a lot of what's going on in the world right now. And how's that working out? As I look around me, not very well. Not to say that all of those things aren't important. They are important. But the universe does not exist for me. So if it's not about me, it's certainly not about you either. You are just a big collection of me's. So that only leaves God. The creator of everything. Doesn't matter to me whether you believe he did it in 6 days, cause it all to happen, it's still God. God, the one who loves me, completely, and no matter what I do, he couldn't love me anymore because he already does, because God's essence is love. The one who loves us all so much, he came to earth in flesh to show us what love is and what love looks like, to live as God intended us to live. God, who gives us his spirit to guide us and prod us and manifest his presence until the world is made new again. I have to confess, in all my years, many, not a century, but many, that I haven't figured it all out. In fact, the older I get, the less and less certain I am about more and more things. I don't know why suffering's allowed. I don't know why all the difficult things around me have happened in my life or around my life. I don't know why Donald Trump got elected. I'm okay with that. I don't like it, but I'm okay with it. Because if there is a God, and there is, and if God loves me, of which I'm completely certain, and totally dependent on, then that belief, that faith, requires me to trust in that God. If it is all about God, what does that mean? There are too many implications of that to explore in the few minutes that I have. But there are a couple of things that are important to me that are very real in terms of my implications. In my relationships, how does that truth play out? How does it play out when conflicts arise? If it was all about me, then I would have to do the things that I do at home to get something in return. And it had better be more than I'd given, because breaking even is not a win. And life is all about the win. I would not back down in any discussion. I would have to win those two. I have to be right. But if it's about God, then all of that changes. Relationships are not about winning, but about losing. Jesus says the least in the kingdom will be the greatest. God has chosen the weak and the meek and the little children as models for us. This seems to me to be very freeing. I don't have to be right. I don't have to win. That's not the point. If it is the point, then I've lost. I was asked many years ago by someone, what was the key to a successful marriage? My answer to that question is the same answer I would give as any key to any successful relationship. Whenever faced with any question, a point of contention, when you find yourself in a disagreement, whatever the issue is, ask yourself, does it matter? Does it matter if my child wants blue hair? Does it matter if the front door is blue or green? Does it matter if we do what my wife, my friend, my coworker wants again? Does it really? That's not to say that I should be apathetic about life or relationships or decisions. God gave us minds to use to make decisions. But so many of the issues that come up that cause tension in relationships, they don't really matter if it's about God. Because it's relationships that matter to God. He cares about them. One more application of the principle is my work life. How does it play out there? I'm at the stage in my life when many around me are retiring or looking forward to retirement. There was a point in my life when golf was a bigger part of it, and I imagined that I would retire in my early 60s, golf 4 or 5 times a week. That would be it. If I were to do that, that life would be one that's all about me, for me. Over the years, I've become a bit more self-aware. I have come to the realization that spending my days entertaining myself is not healthy for me. It's not a healthy way for me to live. I need more structure. I need more purpose. So if it's about God, then my work life and bringing it to a conclusion looks different. For me, it means slowing down gradually, intentionally. But unless I feel that I'm not where I should be and God opens up something else for me, then I'm staying where I am. And that seems like the best way to continue forward. Now, for almost everyone here, the whole concept of retirement is a far-off thing, so far off that it's only a theoretical concept. But the principle of work being all about God is still the same. What does work look like for you if it's all about God? And don't read into what I'm saying that you shouldn't retire or that you can't enjoy and relax during retirement. That's not a bad thing at all. God may have that plan for you, but don't just assume you have to quit what you're doing when you hit that magic age. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Just be open to what may be in front of you and what doors may be opening for you. And just remember, it's not about you.
Dear Nexus, when I think about what I would have wanted to have known when I was younger, I think the most important thing I've learned or am still in the process of learning, I'm always a work in progress, is to be present. For me, there are 3 aspects of being present. First of all, be present with yourself. So much of life is spent looking back at the past, either in nostalgia or in regret, or to the future, either in anticipation or in dread. There's nothing inherently wrong in learning from past mistakes or planning for the future, but so much of our life is spent being somewhere other than in the moment. And I now realize how much just slips by without our true attention to that moment. Take time to notice everything around you and in you. What do you feel? What do you sense? Give yourself permission to really feel your emotions and accept them as part of who you are in that present moment. And when you are truly in touch with who you are, for better or for worse, you are more able to be open to others and to God. And did you know that there is scientific evidence that such mindfulness makes you more flexible over time in how you respond to the world? You become less imprisoned in the past, less imprisoned by your habits, expectations, or assumptions, and more able to respond to events as they unfold. So wake up all of your senses and stimulate your brain in the present so you can be more receptive and alive in the future. Secondly, be present with others. In my earlier years, I was so busy striving to establish myself as fully independent, autonomous, and mature, that whenever I was with people, I didn't fully appreciate them just for who they are. It was always about me trying to analyze and second-guess them, why they were the way they were, why they thought the things they did, and how I could change or fix things for them. I was unsure and unconfident, so much of my time with others was spent trying to prove to myself and to others that I'm worth it, or to defend my own opinions. My perception of others was always through my own lens of who I thought they were and how they could reflect something back to me, rather than just being present in the moment with them. Over the years, I have learned to loosen my grip on my need to feel perfect and worthy. I have learned just to be in the presence of others, seeking to sense and experience the interior essence of them, rather than interpret their words or actions, which just reflects an exterior of them. And so try to discern the reality of Christ within them, even if it is deeply hidden. And how precious to sit in the presence of Christ. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, be present with God. Much of my life was spent running away from God. I questioned my beliefs. I questioned my worthiness. I never felt good enough to be in the presence of God and could never even consider it until I corrected all of that. And when I finally surrendered in faith to God, I would still turn away in shame whenever I felt I had stumbled or failed. I would try to determine the steps needed to be taken to pull myself up enough to be worthy again to be in the presence of God. I always focused on my past behavior and looking forward to correct my future behavior before I felt I could be present with God. But then I became a parent. As a parent, I always longed to be with and hold my kids in every single moment of their lives, both in their perceived failures as well as in their successes. And so I began to understand how much more God, as the perfect parent, longs for my presence at all times in all circumstances. God longs to be present with me, especially in those times when I feel like I've messed up and I don't feel worthy. He longs to be not just with me in extraordinary times of success, but in the ordinary times, doing ordinary things. So prayer for me is no longer just a time set aside to recite requests and confessions, which in the end just focuses on me. But it is an intimate, ongoing conversation that continues all through the day with a sense of honor and awe that I am living out my life in the presence and the embrace of a living God. And so, I've learned that it is when I can allow myself to be fully present with God that I can learn to be fully present with myself, which then allows me to be in that resting place of presence and to be fully present with all the others. And isn't that what the kingdom really is about?
Well, I am the last, but God says she who is last will be first. I don't want you to think that because I'm the last, I'm the oldest. Because I am not. And it doesn't mean I'm the wisest, because I'm not. When Brad asked if I would share on the Wisdom Sunday, my first thought was that he should have asked me when I was 30 years old, because that was when I was really smart and wise and pretty much had life and faith figured out. There were things that were just true, and life worked based on those formulas that you could know. And if you did the right things, believed the right things, then life would work out for you because God has a wonderful plan for your life. In his book, The Pressure's Off, Larry Crabb calls this the law of linearity. There is an action A that you can do and it will lead to result B, the result that you want. That's a lot of pressure, but if you work hard at figuring things out and acting accordingly, you can enjoy the blessings of a life that is working out for you. And for a long time, this actually held true for me. I got the marks. I made the teams. I got the job, married the guy. And as Krabs says, if you believe in the law of linearity and things are going well, you publicly say, praise God. But privately, you whisper, of course, I did it right. Believing this did a few things for me. It gave me a sense of control and a feeling of security. I could get what I wanted in life by doing A, and I would get B. Unfortunately, I can see in hindsight that it also made me very judgmental of others. If you were struggling with life in any way, then you were not seeing life as clearly and correctly as I was. You did not know the formulas, and you did not work hard enough. So what happens when the formulas do not work? As Krabs says, when you are following the law of linearity and life is not working out, we publicly say, God is working for my good. I will trust him. While we privately whisper, what did I do wrong? We believe we must have failed. I did something wrong. I didn't believe the right way. I didn't have enough faith. Maybe I don't believe at all. Maybe I have no faith. It doesn't seem to occur to us that maybe the law of linearity is wrong. Somewhere, probably associated with having kids, I began to question the idea of knowing that action A would lead to outcome B. Life did not seem to be working out quite so precisely for me, and for many other people that I knew. Things just were not as clear, cut and dried, as I had always believed. I could no longer accept that all the struggles in all areas of people's lives were because they were doing something wrong. And around the same time, I began to give voice to some of the questions and doubts that I had about my faith. I had always had some misgivings about the certainty in faith that I had been taught and professed. Again, there were formulas for faith, and I like formulas. But deep inside, I felt things just were not fitting together very neatly. I eventually decided that to be honest about my questions and doubts was far healthier than trying to force the realities of life and faith into a box that they just weren't fitting. Because of the way I'm wired, I would like things to be certain and predictable and in my control, but that's just not reality. Please do not ask any of my children about my need to control. I will deny anything they tell you. My points of wisdom from this are that it's okay to question and to doubt and to not know. It is the journey we are on in life and in faith that is important. It's not getting to the destination or the answer, because frankly, we are never going to get there anyway. Also, I've come to accept that because there are no formulas, our journeys are all going to look very different, and that's okay. This has taken a lot of pressure off me because I had believed that if my faith was valid, my Christian life would look a certain way, but it never did. I should feel this, oh, I should say that, I should believe like they do. My Christian journey just did not look like that of many others. And it's taken me a long time to accept that my journey is okay. Something else that fits in here, and I'm not sure exactly how, but it's the idea that as I journey, I need to realize that I really will never be able to fully understand God. I need to be comfortable with mystery, with paradox, conundrums, and enigmas. This is a real challenge for me. The person who loves math, definite answers, looking it up in the back of the book and seeing that you got the right answer, isn't that great? Yeah. So, where was I here? I think that a risk in all of this way of thinking is that believing that your actions don't determine the outcomes, then is there any real point in trying to figure life out and act wisely? You need to know that the law of influence still holds true. Your actions can definitely influence outcomes. Influence is real, but control is an illusion. I feel this has been a little muddled and disjointed, but that's likely an accurate reflection of my current state of understanding. Muddled and disjointed. And now, at the age of 60, I seem to know so much less than I knew at 30, but I do feel more genuine and that there is more integrity in my beliefs. My greatest fear is that by the time I die, I'm going to know nothing.